what you want, tell me what you see, where you wanna go, what you wanna be. If you have a dream, you can make it there with a lot of work and a lot of prayer. If you take your time, gotta be precise, gotta have a plan, double check it twice. Wait, hold up, slow down, you're gonna need advice. Someone's gone before, maybe talk to them, then after you do, go and talk to him. Wait, it's gonna come, maybe not tonight, take your time today, put your time right.
Got a lot of friends, made a lot of ends, Twitter, you the trend, name a Bentley Benz, but you moving kinda fast, keep sweats, you gotta make it last, live every day like it's your last, but don't forget to have a blast.
Welcome to Time Out. I am your host, Sylvia Crawley Milbury. And when I think about a timeout, it is that period of time where you pause, assess the situation, correct some things, regroup, and resume with another opportunity to perform better. And although this show is primarily about sports and the life lessons they teach us, I will, however, interview people from all career paths highlighting any timeout moments that have caused them to pause, assess, correct, regroup, and resume. Tonight, we have a guest who has had countless timeout moments. This guest is very near and dear to my heart. He is a professor and assistant dean in the communications department at Robert Morris University. He is a member of Kappa Alpha Psi fraternity, where he serves as the Senior Vice Pomark of the Eastern Central Province. Dr. Rex Crawley, thank you for taking time out to be with us tonight. Are you there?
I am here, Sylvia, and thank you for having me.
Now, people have been giving me a hard time about whenever I did a promo for the show to promote the show, it always had Dr. Rex L. Crawley. And so they said, why do you keep putting his middle initial like he's T.D. Jakes or something? Can you tell our listeners what your middle name is and why it is always included whenever they see your name?
My middle name is significant to me because I think my parents or even their parents were brilliant in that two things. One, I speak French, so I am partial to the French language. And Leroy in French means the king, literally Leroy, but it's Leroy in our community. So Leroy means king, and Rex means king in Latin. So those two names combined together, I just think, I've always thought was both powerful and interesting that my parents chose to combine them. So I like the L. It distinguishes me, even though Rex is pretty distinctive. But the L kind of just, you know, always reminds me that my parents had a vision for my life and that centered on greatness.
And also, I want to inform the listeners that my father's middle name is Leroy, and Rex's two sons' middle names are also Leroy, so there is a legacy that's being passed down. You are a survivor. Go ahead.
No, I was gonna say,
did you say something?
Yeah, I said with the four Leroys, right.
You are a survivor of cancer three times, a survivor of bone marrow transplant and open heart surgery. So we know you have some incredible timeouts to share this evening, but we're going to talk about that later in the show. So if you're listening, hold on, stay patient, stay with us. We're going to talk about that a little bit later. I first would like to congratulate you on another successful camp with BMLDI, which stands for Black Male Leadership Development Institute. Congratulations on another camp. You just finished, I think, on Sunday, was it?
Yes, yesterday. I'm still in recovery.
How many campers, roughly, did you have in attendance this year?
This was our largest cohort, and we had 80 African-American high school boys on campus for 7 days.
Wow. And so can you explain to our listeners the purpose of this camp?
Sure. The BMLDI, Black Male Leadership Development Institute, is really an initiative designed to help African-American young men hone their leadership skills And so while we recognize that they're faced with a number of challenges from school to community, this is sort of a timeout for them to say that, you know, I'm interested in being a leader and I'm interested in developing skills. So they get to leave everything behind, come to campus, stay in a residence hall. For some of them, it's the first time ever stepping foot on a college campus, and they get the opportunity to spend 7 days laser-focused on developing their leadership skills.
Now, while they were on campus, they engaged in presentations and activities and skits, just to name a few. Can you talk about the most impactful event that took place at the Institute this past week?
Yeah, so for our Institute, one of the things we pride ourselves on is that the curriculum was designed by African-American men for African-American boys. So it takes more Eurocentric theories and concepts and applies them to the everyday lived experiences of African-American men. So all of the faculty, and we have about 25 African-American leaders that come to campus, and all of them are leaders in the community, and they share ideas and their experiences. So one of the most powerful is that we hired a playwright who came in to talk to the guys, and they did a play, and it's called Don't Shoot My Brother, Shoot Me. And it's a dramatic play that focuses on the impact of black-on-black murder, not on just the victim and the assailant, but also on the communities around them. So the play really centers around how a mother is impacted when her child is murdered at the hand of another black man. At the end of the play, they do a talkback session, and what struck us and just moved us, first question they asked was, how many of you are in a household with a single mom? And I would say 75% of the hands went up. Then they asked the question, how many of you have ever experienced violence, death, murder? And I would say 50% of those hands went up. And when we began to debrief, I mean, these guys, high school, hard, you know, not wanting to show emotions, you know, guys just broke down talking about their brothers that were murdered, their cousins, their uncles, their, you know, men in their lives who have been murdered by other black men. And I think that was one of the most emotional days of the Institute. And then we spent time talking to them things about core ethical values, for example. And we're surprised always at how many guys just never stop to think about their values. And they never make the connection that their behavior is driven by their values. And so we introduce them to a set of core principle values, and we challenge them with case studies to make right decisions and help them understand that everything you do is driven by a set of values that you either embrace or you disregard. So we spend, again, they are exhausted mentally when we finish this camp.
Wow. I think everyone needs that camp. You also wear another hat as a researcher. You recently received a grant for $1.8 million to establish what is now up and operating as the Usuri Think Tank Research Center. Please tell our listeners about your research center.
The Usuri Think Tank is unique, and I think one of the reasons why it was so fundable is because we proposed a research center that operated from what we call an anti-deficit model. So when we looked at all the research about African-American males and educational success, we found most of the research centered on negative statistical indicators. And when we tried to find some positive research about black men, there were only a few articles. And so we said, you know what? We want to create an organization, a research think tank, whose sole focus is positive experiences in academia. So our laser focus is academic success. And specifically, we are interested in uncovering academic success factors. So we want to be able to say at the end of the day that here are some things that single moms and families and teachers and university professors can use to encourage academic success in African-American men and boys.
Wow. So how did you feel when you found out that the grant for your research was awarded?
It's really interesting because I wrote the grant in one of my timeout moments. In fact, I don't know if I'm jumping ahead for you, but in fact,
go ahead. It's fine.
Okay, I have been. We I had come out of remission from cancer after 12 years and was in the hospital going through chemotherapy, and I'm not necessarily a good patient because I'm in the hospital with my laptop, my iPad, my iPhone, you know, my books, and, you know, instead of spending all my time watching TV, I decided to work on this grant proposal. And it was the proposal for the Usuri Think Tank. And I had, you know, days, weeks in the hospital where I had the opportunity to just really laser focus on it. So did a really great job. When I got out of the hospital, was in remission, my first week back to work, we got a call from our funder saying, we love the idea, we love the concept, and we've agreed at our board meeting to fund it and to endow it at $900,000, and our university called and said, you know what, and we're going to match that $900,000 for a total of $1.8 million because we so believe in the mission of this research center.
Wow. So how did you come up with the name Usuri Think Tank Research Center?
Well, because this center is focused on African-American male success, we knew we wanted a Afrocentric term that was reflective of the experience based on sort of Kwanzaa and a number of principles associated with the African-American community. We thought it would be interesting to kind of do a scan of Swahili terms that we thought kind of reflected our vision. And Usuri is a Swahili term that has multiple meanings, or at least two that we were able to find. One is beautiful, which we think sort of reflects the African-American male experience, and the other was brilliance. And when we saw that term brilliance, we knew that that was exactly the term that we could use to sort of capture the essence of what we were trying to do.
Right. So I have a question from Michelle Mullins. She is from Kingwood, Texas. And her question is, how is the research coming along, and are you finding some aspects other studies have overlooked?
We are beyond excited. In fact, our launch event is on June 27th at Robert Morse University in Moon Township, Pennsylvania. And it's at that event where we're going to introduce our first longitudinal study, which is an attempt at identifying success factors from successful African-American men. So what we've been doing since we started in January, has been identifying guys who have had academic success, and these are seasoned professionals, and we're interviewing them, asking them to tell us their story, their academic life stories. Once we've collected those stories, we go back and analyze them, hoping that themes will emerge to give us some indicator of the success factors that impacted their lives. And so at this event on the 27th, we pinpointed three particular leaders. One is an African-American president of a college here in Pittsburgh, the largest community college in western Pennsylvania. The other is the dean of social work at the University of Pittsburgh. And then finally, we have one of the pastors of one of the largest African-American churches in Pittsburgh, and he is a theologian and also has a doctorate degree. And so they are featured during this program, and we are going to introduce to the audience and the community the success factors that emerge from their interviews. And then, excitingly, we have these, I don't know if you've ever heard of automated response systems, but there are these little clickers, so we can ask the audience questions and they can respond, and the responses are depicted on the screen in graph form, so we can get real live survey data right there in this space, and that information is then uploaded into a database, and at the end of the day, we will have a publication as a result of this event on Thursday. So it's exciting. It's a merger of technology and in-depth interviewing, and most importantly, African-American male voices.
Right. You said when I was speaking to you earlier preparing for this show, you said that there were two things specifically that you kind of found in your studies. Can you talk to us a little bit about that? Reading was one of them.
Sure. So we identified 11 success factors out of these three in-depth interviews. And one, interestingly, was reading. And some folks may not be surprised at that. But we were relatively surprised because one of the things that we realized after we did some in-depth work with these whole issue of reading is that most African American men, or I have to say some, and even a large percentage, are just not reading at grade level. When I was getting my master's degree at Ohio University, I had a white university professor, after he gave me an exam back, suggest that I go to the library and take a reading course. I went to the ombudsman and charged him with racism. I was like, I'm a grassroots, how dare he say I can't read? I called my mom and told her, and she was like, take your butt to the library and see what he's talking about. So I went to the library. They tested me. My reading speed and comprehension was at like 11th grade level. So I immediately signed up for a speed reading course. By the end of the course, I was reading at grade level, and it changed my life. You know, there was a time when a professor would give me, if I was in a poli-sci class and they said, read chapters 3, 4, and 5 by Wednesday, I was like, is he insane? Where's the cliff notes? I'm not reading 3 chapters in 3 days. This is not possible, right? No idea that I was, you know, the issue was that I read slow. And so what we found and what we tell our advisees and mentees now is that African-American men tend not to do anything that they don't do well. And so when we survey our guys and ask them, how many books do you plan to read this summer? I ain't reading no books this summer. I only read for class. Or even we ask professionals about reading. Very few admit that leisure reading is something that they do, that, you know, I just prefer to do more active things. And so that's one of the sort of revelations in all of this is that, you know, we tend to not like to do anything we don't do well. And so part of this movement is this whole notion of, you know, reading is fundamental, and we've got to get our black boys back into the libraries. We've got to get them reading, and we got to get them reading at grade level. So that was one of the success factors. Okay.
And I was just going to say the other one.
The other one, interestingly, is study skills. So when this emerged as a success factor, we began to talk to folks about study skills and ask the question, where did you learn to study? You know, give us your point of first remembrance where someone taught you how to study. And, you know, we get the blank looks from folks like, well, I mean, nobody ever taught me how to study. I kind of just figured it out. I kind of learned it. I just do it. And so when I have students come into my office who aren't doing well in the class, and I ask them how they study, they say, well, I read my notes. Let me see your notes. And I look at their notes, and I'm saying, are you serious? So this is where you think is going to get you A in the class? Well, that and, you know, the textbook. But you don't read. You know, you haven't even read the book. So how is there this expectation that you're going to do well academically if you don't know how to study and you're not reading at grade level? So it's an amazing phenomenon. And we talk to other folks who are successful, and they say that they have had exposure to study skills. My wife, who is a graduate of Cornell University, who shared that, you know, everybody at Cornell goes through a study skills course. It's required for freshmen. You know, it's an Ivy League school. Sylvia, you and I had the conversation about Boston College. In schools that their reputation is based on their intellectual rigor, they want to make sure their students are doing well. So they know that most students have not been taught how to study, so they take the initiative and make sure they teach it. And that's just not happening for the African-American men that we're talking to. They have never been exposed to intensive study skills training. And so that becomes another one of the deliverables or one of the success factors that we talk about.
I want to say thank God our mom made us do our homework, and thank God they made us go to summer school to take reading classes. I'll never forget when our mom made me go to summer school and take a reading class. I said, Mom, I can read. Why do I have to do this? It's summertime, you know. She said, listen, your brother went to reading class. You going to take a reading class because you don't know how to read. And so it was then that I learned how to speed read. But, you know, if you don't have a parent at home that is enforcing that and enforcing that you do your homework when you come home from school and you have developed those studying skills, then when you go to college, you're overwhelmed.
Well, I mean, you have the benefit of being brilliant because, you know, you were the product of the trial and error that mommy and daddy enforced upon us. So everything we did wrong, they made sure you did right in some cases, because we actually think you got away with a lot.
Of course. We're going to take a quick one-minute break. We are preparing our listeners for the commercials that are coming. We have some sponsorship, and we're going to start inserting commercials, but we're advertising the other shows on our Blog Talk Radio that's within our Blog Talk Radio family. So hold your seats. We will be right back with Timeout Moments from Rex Crowley.
For a roundup of the week's events, interviews, and a whole lot more, tune in every Thursday at 8 p.m. Eastern for the FSP Cruise Show, featured at blogtalkradio.com/VICHBK. Here's a sample.
We have Mr. Stephen A. Smith. Hello, Stephen A. I'm glad to, this is Jerry, your host, along with my co-host Black and Jeff on here. Glad to,
What's up, fellas? How y'all doing?
What's going on, Stephen?
Good. Thanks for joining us.
Not a problem.
You can also visit fantasysportsandpolitics.webs.com for archives, advertising, and other information. The FSP Crew Show. Information, motivation, variety.
You are listening to Time Out with Sylvia Crowley. We just heard from Dr. Rex Crowley about his hat as a programmer as well as his hat as a researcher. Dr. Crowley, can you explain to us the difference of the two? Because I think some people kind of get your BMLD I camp mixed up with the Think Tank Research Center.
Yeah, and it is easy to do. And so, first of all, you know, I describe it by sharing with folks that it's two very separate pots of money. So our Leadership Institute is funded, and its goal is to provide programming for leadership development. And then the Usuri Think Tank is a research center. So we don't do any programming at the research center level. So they are relatively connected because obviously the research can inform the programming. So, for example, the theme of reading or reading at grade level emerges from our research, and then a program like the Leadership Institute can pick up and say, well, we're going to respond to that by creating a program that is responsive. And so programming versus research are two very different endeavors, and you're right, two very different hats that I wear.
Okay, I want to transition into your life story. I know this is what the listeners are kind of waiting for. When you left home from college, did you ever think that you would be doing what you're doing now?
Oh, no way. I mean, I left home from college following my older sister and my hero, who was at Ohio University. I didn't even apply to another school. I didn't even send my information to any other school. I knew I was going to Ohio University where my big sister was. And so I left there with no clue of what I was going to do or end up doing. In fact, I started out as a computer science major and changed that within the first quarter, and then decided on political science because I had aspirations to be a lawyer, actually.
Wow, I didn't know you majored in computer science. That's new information for me. But you pledged Kappa Alpha Psi, and when you pledged, it was during a time where hazing was still going on. What made you want to pledge Kappa, not once, but I believe you had to pledge twice?
What? I pledged twice.
I thought you had to go online again.
No, I wouldn't be a cop if I had to do that again.
But I was under the impression you took a break and went to France, and when you came back, you had to start all over again.
No. I actually went to France after I was a member of Kappa Alpha Psi. But the reason I was interested in Kappa Alpha Psi is that in Steubenville, everybody that I knew that was a member of a Greek organization were Kappas. So when I came to campus, it was not even a question of what organization I belonged to. In fact, when folks heard I was from Steubenville, they would be like, you're from Nukeville, USA. I know you're going to be the Kappa. You know, and so it was just no question. My cousins were Kappas. You know, my friends who went to school before me pledged Kappa. And those were all guys that I just admire. I looked at with awe and was just like, you know, when I go to college, I'm going to be a Kappa. So it was no question for me. It took me 3 years to do it. I played my junior year. I had to spend some time, you know, making sure that my grades were right and that, you know, I was kind of ready for the experience. But you're right, pledging was somewhat legal. It was right at the turn of the sort of anti-hazing movement. And so, and we were in Athens, Ohio, in the middle of nowhere. And so, you know, there was some pretty intense stuff happening to become members of Greek letter organizations.
So you went into it with one intent, but you came out with a different knowledge in terms of what your fraternity could provide for you. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Sure. You know, when my sophomore year, I came back to school knowing that I wanted to sort of be involved in the African-American community. And I figured, you know, what better way than to sort of be Greek and to be a Kappa. At that time, the Kappas were running the yard and still do nationwide. That was the plug. But I wanted to be a Kappa because I wanted to be a part of the black community on campus. And I also was attracted to the way that the guys carried themselves, the reputations they had, you know, stepping, twirling canes, all of those things were attractive to me. Once I became a member of the fraternity, I realized that it was actually a leadership opportunity. So I became an officer in the fraternity and realized that parties just don't happen and community service don't just happen, that in fact all of those things had to be planned. And so it was in my undergraduate student days that I really learned to be a programmer, that I was able to sit down with a group of men and plan an event that had a purpose and a goal and make sure that that event met those purposes and goals. So it was excellent training for actually what I'm doing now. In fact, at Ohio University, I was the founder of the Ohio University Black Man Think Tank, where every year we would bring in notable keynote speakers. We've had Jawanza Kanjufu. We had speakers from all over the country. Cornell West came to Ohio University, and we had them share with African-American students about this issue of academic success.
Okay. So you're at Ohio University. You're a Kappa. You went for political science. You graduated, and then you went to get your master's degree. Can you tell our listeners what you got your master's degree in?
So I got my master's in public administration. After I got my master's, my undergrad in political science, I realized that I had no clue what a political scientist was, and I realized that not a bit any employers. So it was critical that I got a master's degree to get a job. So after I got my degree in public administration, I was hired by then-Governor Mario Cuomo to come to New York State in Albany, New York, where I worked as a budget examiner for the New York State Division of the Budget. So that was wonderful. It was my first real job. I got my first brand-new car. You know, and I was, you know, it was a red Geo Storm. I could barely get in it, but it was bad. But, you know, it was a transition in my life, really, from you know, student to professional, and it was a great time while I was in Albany, New York, is actually when I was first diagnosed with lymphoma.
Yeah, that leads to my next question. How old were you when you found out that you had lymphoma cancer?
I had just turned 30, so, you know, I was, you know, just everything going well, had not been to the doctor or the hospital, and you know, years since I was a kid and had asthma, you know, was in the prime of my life. And I remember going to work one morning and having trouble getting up the steps. And I'm like, you know, when you're a young guy, you just don't think of being sick. I'm thinking, oh, I worked out too hard in the gym or, you know, I'm getting a cold or whatever. But it got progressively worse. It never even dawned on me to go to the doctor or go to the hospital. So much so that by the end of the day, I had trouble getting down the steps. And then the next day, I still didn't go to the hospital, so I just went to work early, like at 6 a.m., because I didn't want anybody to see me struggling up the steps. And I waited till everybody left because I didn't want anybody to see me struggling to get to my car. And I didn't even make it to my car. I was sitting on the curb, and I was just like, okay, something is wrong. Like, I'm dying. So I got in my car, went to the hospital, and the emergency room, they tested my blood oxygen, and they were like, oh, my God, like, you have no, you're not getting oxygen in your blood cells, and scheduled me for an emergency CAT scan. And the results came back initially that there was just a tumor the size of a grapefruit in my abdomen that was lodged up against one of the vessels to my left lung. And so that was why I couldn't breathe and I wasn't getting oxygen. So they then had to biopsy that tumor to find out exactly what it was. And it was, you know, sometime later that week that it was discovered that I had lymphoma non-Hodgkin's disease.
Wow. So you had to go through chemotherapy and talk about that experience and kind of what your body goes through when you go through chemotherapy.
Yeah, well, it was interesting because, again, I was in Albany, New York, and it was the summertime, and I'll never forget when the day the doctor told me I had cancer was the day of my family reunion in Ohio, and I didn't want my family to be worried, and I was just in total denial. So I didn't even tell them for a couple of days until it was time for me to be released. And I realized I needed somebody to come get me. So I called my parents and told them, Sylvia, you were in North Carolina at the time playing for the Tar Heels. And we called you, and Coach Hatchell's mother, I think, had been going through chemotherapy. And you were like, get him down here to Duke University. It's the best cancer center, you know, in the world. So my mom and dad drove up and got me. We drove straight to North Carolina and got a second opinion. And that's where they confirmed that I, in fact, had cancer. So I started immediately after that, started chemotherapy at Ohio State University because it just so happened that the chief of oncology was transferring to Ohio State. And, I was in Ohio. That was my hometown, so it made sense for me to be treated at Ohio State by him. Chemotherapy, I kept a blog the last time I went through chemotherapy, and one of the blog entries talks about the feeling of poison being intravenously injected into your veins, because chemotherapy is a drug. It's designed to burn all fast-growing cells. So that's the only way they can get the cancer, and chemotherapy can't distinguish a cancer cell from a hair cell. You know, so it goes into your body and just destroys everything. And you literally feel that happening. I don't know if anyone could connect with the feeling of your skin burning, which is a fast-growing cell, and the hair in your skin burning. To be conscious of and feel that is just a bizarre, to say the least, feeling to know that that's happening to your body.
Wow. So because you had lymphoma cancer, which is cancer of the lymph nodes, and it's different from other types of cancer, like, for example, if you have breast cancer, sometimes you just remove the breast and you can, get rid of the cancer. But because your lymph nodes are all over your body, you can't really remove it. So you had to have a bone marrow transplant. Can you talk about that experience?
Well, so I went through a year of chemotherapy, and after the chemotherapy went into remission, and that probably was about for a year. And so during that year's time, I got accepted into graduate school to get my PhD. So I'm in remission. I'm celebrating life. Everybody's celebrating with me, cancer-free. And, within my doctoral program, not even a year when I felt my body not the same again. And same kind of emotional and psychological situation. I was in denial. I knew things were happening in my body. I just did not want to go there emotionally. And so it got to the point where I had no choice. So, again, I was experiencing extreme difficulty. So this time when I went to the oncologist, they shared with me, that because I had already gone through chemotherapy, that the cancer had grown resistant to it, so chemotherapy was not an option this time, and that I needed to have a bone marrow transplant. And so for a bone marrow transplant, you have to have a donor. And the only one that will be 100% match for you is a sibling, because they have your exact gene types, the combination of both your mom and your dad. So, Sylvia, you probably remember getting a call saying, we need to test you to see if you're a match for Rex to be a donor for him. And likewise, mm-hmm. Sylvia. And so it was traumatic, the sort of waiting period, like, is one of them going to be a match? I think Helen got tested first, and she was not a match. You were playing basketball. It was the basketball season, I believe. And so we had to kind of wait for you to come home to get tested. And we just knew that, you know, you were going to beat a match, right, because we're so close, and it's just like, you know, you're like little mini-me. And when the results came back that you were not a match, it was pretty devastating because we knew we were facing crisis. Do you remember that?
I do remember it.
Yeah. So the interesting thing was then that we had to go to the bone marrow registry. And I remember them telling me, quite frankly, well, this is going to be a challenge because African-Americans tend not to donate. And so we don't have a lot of African-Americans on the registry. So the probability of finding you an exact match is slim, and even a close match is slim. So they ended up finding someone that was like an 80% match, which meant that there was a 20% chance of rejection. And if your body rejects someone else's bone marrow, there's a high probability that you won't survive. So I was not comfortable with that 20% chance. So we dug a little further, and it just so happened it was at the time of stem cell research. And so one of my brilliant oncologists came to me and said, hey, there's this new procedure. Less than 100 people have had it done, and it's called a stem cell transplant. We can take your bone marrow out. We can introduce massive doses of chemotherapy, and because you're 31 years old, we can really blast you. Like most people who have lymphoma are in their 50s or 60s, and so they would die of the chemotherapy blast trying to kill all the cancer cells once they took the bone marrow out. And they were like, but because you're 30, we can really hit you, man. We can, you know, blast all this cancer out. And I'm like, what? You know, but it worked. I mean, they introduced, I had a bubble experience. All of my bone marrow was gone, and I was in intensive chemotherapy. I had no immune system. I couldn't, you know, be around people. I couldn't be around things. All of my mail had to come through this little screening room and be ultraviolently scanned, and it was an amazing process. But thanks be to God, you know, being one of the first persons to have a bone marrow transplant and then to have a successful bone marrow transplant was absolutely amazing.
Wow. I was with you throughout this whole process, but to kind of hear it again in order of how it happened, it's amazing. So we often hear about how devastating it is for women to go through chemotherapy and just the whole process of them losing their hair. And for women, they either have to get comfortable with wearing a bald head, which is a huge deal for a woman, or wear a wig. Talk to our listeners about the transitions that you went through mentally as a young man to lose your hair, your mustache, your beard, your eyebrows, et cetera.
Oh, yeah. I was an escrow king. You know, I was all about my do, you know, droop to the side. And, you know, I had stock in S-Curl, Jerry Curl juice. but really, really, my hair was part of my identity. And I'll never forget, I was in church, and I put my hand on my head to scratch it or something, and I pulled my hand out, and I had a head full of hair and a big bald spot, and I was traumatized. I cried. You know, and I went home, and I was just like, oh, my God, I got this big patch, and every time I touched my hair, it just fell out. So, you know, I got the clippers, and I just shaved it off, and I was just like, oh, my goodness, I can't believe this. And I wore a hat for like 2 weeks, and I remember when I finally took the hat off, and someone came to me and was like, dude, you look like Michael Jordan, because that was right when Michael Jordan was making bald head, you know, hot, right? So everybody was like, dang, I look good on you. Like, you shaved your head like Mike. You know, and I was like, okay, I could rock this. And needless to say, I have not had hair since. I don't even know. I wonder if my hair would grow back. I don't know. But I've been rocking the bald head since, you know, 1995. But it was traumatic. I never knew that I was so attached to my hair. But what was even more traumatic was the loss of eyebrows and eyelashes and facial hair and underarm hair and pubic hair and just feeling like You know, I'm like 6'4", 200 pounds with, you know, looking like little baby Huey, you know, and probably more traumatizing, feeling like I look like a cancer patient. Like people would look at me and be like, something wrong, you know? And it was tough. It was tough dealing with the physical transformation from being healthy to being obviously sick.
Wow. So at this point in time, now you are in pursuit of your PhD, and you find out that you know, as if it's not enough to have been diagnosed with cancer and then have to experience a bone marrow transplant, but at that time you learned that you needed open heart surgery. Talk to me, and in our conversation, you said that this is what you consider to be your biggest timeout moment, and you've had many, but talk to us about that timeout moment in your life.
Yeah, this was probably the most significant. And Sylvia, I share with you, like when I had cancer, I never felt like I was going to die. I looked like I was going to die, but I never felt like I was going to die. And I always believed that if I was going to die, that somehow God would let me know to get ready and prepare. And I would just know. And I just, you know, as crazy as it sounds, and even as, you know, folks were going through this with me, and lots of folks didn't think I would survive. I have people come up to me now and say, oh, my God, you look just like this dude, you know, that I knew at Ohio University, Rex Crowley. I don't even know if he's still alive. Are you related to Rex Crowley? And I'm looking at them like, Tanya, it's me. And they're like, oh, my God. You know, it's crazy. But the open-heart surgery was a very different circumstance. So as a result of all of the chemotherapy and the bone marrow transplant, my blood began to clot. And I guess this can be one of the symptoms of a massive chemotherapy. And so I had a blood clot that was lodged between my heart and my lung, and all of a sudden I was having extreme breathing difficulties again. And I thought it was, you know, recurrence of cancer. We did all the tests, and it's like, no, that's not it. And they finally narrowed it down to a blood clot. And time was running out because I literally was not able to get blood to my heart and lungs. So I actually was flown to San Diego, California, to have a procedure called a thrombolectomy, which is an open heart surgery procedure where they literally open up my chest, take my heart out, sit it on a table, and then begin to pull all of the clots out of the arteries and veins leading to my heart and my lungs. The amazing thing, and Sylvia will recall this, that during the surgery, the physicians had insight enough to say, this was so massive that we want to take a picture of it. And they put it on a table next to a measuring stick so that I can see, you know, the size of this clot that was lodged between my heart and lungs, pulled it out, and sat there and took a picture of it. I told Sylvia during that surgery, actually, Sylvia, you were there with me, so I didn't have to tell you, but the night before my surgery, I remember hearing a code blue. And when I got to the hospital, there were like 10 of us who were going through the exact same procedure who had flown to San Diego because this surgeon had a high success rate. And the only other African-American woman in my cohort or class had the surgery the day before me. And I was scheduled to go down for prep at like 5 o'clock in the morning, and at 3:30, 4 o'clock, I heard the code blue on the floor. I heard the nurses running and scrambling. And, you know, in my mind, I'm saying, Jesus, 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 I'm not even going to think about this. I'm going to pretend like it, you know, I don't even know this happened, and tried to block it out. But in my heart and mind and spirit, I knew that, you know, my friend did not successfully make it through. And so I think that was probably the one time when I felt that incompatibility in terms of fear and faith, and I was afraid, unlike any other times that I had experienced medical crisis, and just not knowing whether or not I was going to survive this. So it was clearly, you know, a major timeout for me.
I remember our entire family was in San Diego, and we really bonded with the other African-American family that was there for the other young lady to get open-heart surgery. And, you know, we went out to eat together. We, you know, we prayed together. And then she had her surgery first, and she didn't make it. And we were thinking, oh, my goodness, this is the same surgery Rex has to have tomorrow, you know. So we're not going to tell him, you know, let's not tell him because we want him to have positive thoughts going into it. And you asked us, you know, because I guess you had heard the code blue sirens or whatever, but you asked about her. And we were just avoiding the question. You know, we were just like, we cannot tell him. So I just remember it being a very intense moment, you know, for our entire family. I do recall, and I shared this with you earlier today, I do recall that when your surgery was successfully finished, you know, they said the surgery was a success. He'll probably sleep for a couple of days, but we suggest that you talk to him. And we're not 100% sure whether or not the patients can really hear you during this state, but we feel like they can. So it's just, you know, just say positive things to them and encourage them to, you know, to wake up and to fight, you know. So my sister and I, Helen and I, we sat by your bed and we said, hey, Rex, you know, we want you to get better so you can graduate and get your PhD, and we're going to throw a big party for you, and we're going to write Oprah and tell her your story. And Helen said that part. And I said, yeah, we're going to get Yolanda Adams to come sing at your graduation party. And we just said a bunch of random stuff that, you know, all your favorite things. You know, we were throwing out Anita Baker, and and we threw out these random things that we knew you loved so that you would just fight to come back, you know. And when you opened up your eyes, the first thing you said to us was, hey, did y'all say y'all were going to bring Yolanda Adams to my party? And we just, our eyes were so big, we were like, oh, he heard everything we said. But we were just so happy for you to open up your eyes. I remember before you went to your surgery, you tried to hand me a letter that outlined, you know, your funeral. And I was thinking, I'm not taking that. You're going to live. Don't give it to me. And I think you ended up giving it to my dad. But it was a very intense moment. We witnessed a miracle right before our eyes when you woke up from your surgery. So that was a timeout moment for all of us.
Well, I remember in the orientation, and they outlined everything. They showed us pictures of what's going to happen, how it happened, and what the protocol is for recovery. And, like, after the surgery, you'll be unconscious for, like, 2 days. So I think my surgery was, like, on a Friday. And when I woke up, it was, like, Wednesday. And I was like, what day is it? You know, and I had I was intubated. So I'm writing down, like, what day is it? And nobody wanted to write down or say what day it was because y'all knew that I knew I was supposed to be, you know, out of this thing by, like, Tuesday. So when I realized that I was not according to protocol, that's when I started getting nervous again, like, what's wrong? I'm, like, trying to move my legs. Like, okay, left leg work, right leg work, you know. But it was, yeah, it was an intense moment. And the recovery, you know, was also intense. I mean, I couldn't walk. I had to relearn everything. It took me, you know, months to be able to walk 100 feet. And, you know, we're having to walk around with an oxygen tank for months. You know, in the house we had a cord for my oxygen tank that spanned the whole length of our house. I felt like a dog on a leash. You know, if I went to the mall, I had to carry our oxygen tank on wheels. So, you know, it was crazy.
I do want our listeners to know that Rex recovered and he graduated with his PhD in cross-cultural communications. Did you have an oxygen tank at graduation, Rex?
No. Actually, by the time I graduated, it was a year later, and I was fully recovered. I pimped across the stage.
I gave you a standing ovation. I'm not sure if anybody else was standing, but I was standing. Can you talk about your scars from open-heart surgery? Because obviously they cut your chest and put a big scar right down the middle of your chest. Can you talk about the residuals that you're left with as a reminder of that timeout moment in your life?
Yeah, that's really interesting. I'm actually at one point want to write about it because in my mind I call it I call them invisible scars. Immediately after the surgery, whenever I looked in the mirror, you know, it took me a while to see my face if my shirt was off. I couldn't see anything but that scar that went from the bottom of my neck, my esophagus, halfway down my chest. And so it was crazy that that's all I could see when I looked in the mirror. And, you know, 12 years into remission now, the scar is still there, and it's probably still as prominent. But now, you know, I was just sharing with Sylvia today that I don't see it. You know, like I have to remind myself to focus, to look and see it. And I'm not even, I live my life, if I go swimming, I take my shirt off, I just don't even think about I have this scar. But there are folks who are open heart surgery survivors who recognize the scar and have come up to me and said, hey, you're a club member. And I'm like, what are you talking about? And they point to their scar and I'm like, oh, yeah. You know, like people could see this, you know, and I'm just not even conscious of it anymore. At one point, I thought about getting a tattoo over it, and like put in, you know, make it into like an anchor, and put two little circles at the bottom of it, and make it look like a hook. But I was just like, you know what? It's a battle scar, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It is. You told me a funny story about when you were in the pool with your son Xavier the other day. Can you share that with our listeners?
Yeah, actually it was yesterday. So I've recently had to have another surgery. So I have a vertical scar from my neck to halfway down my stomach. And then I have a horizontal scar across my belly where they had to do surgery. And that this was recent. And so, again, you know, these are my invisible scars. So I take off my shirt, my son and his friends are in the pool, and I'm coming down the steps into the pool trying to suck in my gut, act like I got a six-pack. And my son says to my nieces, hey, look at Daddy's boo-boo. You know, and I'm thinking, like, what is he talking about? You know, I'm looking around like, is he what? You know, and they're like, ooh, Uncle Rex. And, you know, they start pointing to the scars on my chest, and I'm like, oh, yeah, and they're like, wow, and this, you have stitches here. And I also have a port. I still have a port in my chest, which is for IVs and for chemotherapy. It's called a power point. And they put a power port, and they put it under your skin. So it's not really visible, but you can still see the scars from the surgery. So my chest is, like, majorly scarred up, and I'm still not conscious of it. When he said that, I was just like, oh, yeah, like I just became conscious again of the fact that, you know, that my experiences are made manifest on my body, and it's just amazing to me that most of the time I'm not conscious of that.
This reminds me of a story you told me about a student that you had that had to have open-heart surgery. Do you remember telling me that story?
Refresh my memory.
You had a student who was missing classes, and he was on the football team, and he started missing football practice. So you called him in the office to find out what was going on because his coach came to you and said, hey, you know, I haven't seen him at practice, and I know he's in your class. Is that refreshing your memory, Eddie?
Yeah. I mean, and again, it's indicative of sort of my life and how my story has sort of become, it forced me to be an ally in so many different ways. So I've had open heart surgery survivors come to me and say that, you know, you're an inspiration, or other folks who know my story say, I have a young guy. You'd be surprised how many college students are going through chemotherapy and have experiences with cancer. And so that's one of the reasons why I try to be public with mine, because I want to be able to talk to someone and say, look, I was a graduate student going through chemotherapy and a bone marrow transplant and open heart surgery. I did it. And when they leave out of my office, they at least have a sense of, you know, like, wow, this is not the end. I am not going to die. You know, here's a man that survived this, and so can I. And so my message is always this notion of the relationship between fear and faith, that they are just incompatible, that if you're afraid, then that means your faith is under attack. Because if you believe that God can heal you and God will protect you, then it doesn't make sense for you to be afraid. And if you are afraid, it means that you really don't believe it. And so you've got to figure out how to get your mind around a faith relationship with God such that when I say I believe you, God, that means I don't have to be afraid. You know, and God has used that revelation to help me get through so many circumstances that when I get afraid or nervous, I know that Satan is trying to attack my faith, and I begin immediately to pray the faith prayer.
Wow, we're going to take a quick break, and we'll be right back with Dr. Rex Crawley.
If you love sports, you're in store for a treat. Every Sunday at 10 a.m. Eastern, you can tune into The Master Plan with Jerry the Master Taylor, featured at blogtalkradio.com/VICHBK. The Master Plan features
a little bit of this, a little bit of that, a little bit of NBA, a little bit of baseball, a little bit of basketball, a little bit of football, a little bit of everything. And this is The Master Plan.
You can also visit fantasysportsandpolitics.webs.com for archives, advertising, and other information. The Master Plan. Information, motivation, variety.
We are back with Time Out with Sylvia Crawley. I have Dr. Rex here on the call. Rex, let's talk about 12 years later, your cancer came back into remission. And this is just when you thought, you know, cancer was behind you, you got your bone marrow transplant, you had the open heart surgery, you've shared your testimony, you know, with students and different people who have gone through similar issues, and now 12 years later, the cancer comes back. Talk to our listeners about that moment in your life.
Yeah, so, I mean, it's almost surreal, and oftentimes when I think about it and look back, and it's really just been a year, but it feels like a lifetime ago that after having come through a wilderness experience and you think you're now in the promised land and you get deep in the promised land and you realize on the other side of the street is the wilderness again. And that's pretty much how I describe it, that, you know, I go to the doctor's for a annual checkup, thinking, you know, I do this every year. You know, I get a PET scan, I get CAT scans, and they tell me everything is great. See you next year. Well, this time I got a call back from the doctor who said, I need you to come in. I need to talk to you. And I'm saying, you need to tell me now what's going on. And over the phone, he told me, he was like, well, to be frank with you, we see some activity on your PET scan that is indicating, you know, that it might be lymphoma again. You know, and I'm thinking, what? You know, because now I'm married. Now I have a son, and I am, you know, assistant dean. I am on the, you know, track for a promotion. I was already a full professor, and everything is perfect. And you're telling me what? So, it was devastating. I remember trying to think in my mind, how do I share this with my wife, who was not a part of my experience when I went through cancer the first time. So recognizing that, you know, my family was pretty much prepared and built up and safe that, and Sylvia, we even talked about it, and you said, you know, when you got the call, you were like, okay, here we go again, kind of, you know. And so I was wondering, how in the world do I come home and tell my wife, who lost her mother 3 years ago, who her sister died of cancer last year, and her father had just passed away, and her older brother died of cancer probably 7 or 8 years ago. So how do I come home to this woman, you know, the mother of my child, and say, you know, me, your husband, has cancer now, and how is she going to deal with it? And so I was really consumed with, you know, the people around me, and particularly my immediate family. So it was kind of devastating. But again, it was, you know, not as unto death. Like, I did not hear that and think, you know, oh, my God, I'm going to die this time. I thought, okay, you know, how inconvenient is this going to be, you know?
Mm-hmm. So the third time around, you talked about how you kept a blog. Talk about how that time was different where, you know, keeping a blog, you were publicizing your experience versus the first time where you didn't want people to know and you were in denial. And you even said earlier that you went to work early so people wouldn't see how slow you were moving, you know. So talk about your mindset the third time, and you touched on it a little bit, but your mindset the third time around that you had to go through chemotherapy and possibly even another bone marrow transplant.
Right. So post, you know, all of this, I have become a cancer activist. I was named to the National Board for the National Marrow Donors Program housed out of Minneapolis, and our goal was to recruit people for the marrow registry, so I'm, you know, actively working. I've been president of the American Cancer Society, you know, in my local city, and had, you know, just been an activist for cancer research. And so this time I came into this recognizing that there was so much about the experience last time that I could not even remember. It really felt like all of that 12 years ago happened to someone else. And the human mind and memory is really interesting because every time, you know, I would think about a story or tell a story or hear someone tell a story, it seemed like it always changed a little bit. You know, so I always wondered, like, what actually happened, you know? And so I really wanted to make sure that this time, not only for myself as a journal, but also I recognized that African-American men tend not to communicate. And so there were so many people whose fathers and brothers and uncles were going through cancer, and they just could not, you know, get in there and connect with them. They asked their dad how they're doing, and he says, fine. Well, I know you're not fine. You just had a chemotherapy treatment. Like, and they wanted to know what it feels like. They want to know what you're thinking when you're going through this. So I thought it was a wonderful research opportunity for me to be able to chronicle this experience, and it ends up being extremely empowering. Because anything that happened to me, I had to understand it. So I drove my doctors crazy. So when they said, you know, we need to do this, I said, so what does that mean, and why are you doing that, and how are you going to do it, and why this versus this, and was able to document all of those decisions and procedures and medications, you know, are all a part of that blog experience, which is something that, you know, I'll always have. And it ended up being empowering because it was how I was able to emotionally deal with some of the issues. Even if I couldn't communicate them verbally, I was able to sort of communicate in writing some of the things that were going on. And it was fascinating because I had a huge readership. You know, people were, you know, just reaching out saying, thank you so much for sharing. And I can't believe how detailed you are about every little thing that's happening to you. And it's helped me understand the cancer experience so much more deeply. And again, it just became empowering for me.
Well, so you talked a little bit about your wife, Daria. Were you ever hesitant to bring her into the situation? Because when you met her, you had already dealt with the cancer, with the bone marrow transplant, with the open heart surgery. So, you know, when you're trying to make the decision to propose to for someone to be in your life forever, which our parents have been married for 52 years, so it's a lifelong, eternal decision for us. did you go through thoughts of were you hesitant at all to bring her into this type of situation?
Oh, without question. I mean, I got married at 40. And I think it was because I was a cancer survivor. So I spent, you know, all of my 30s, you know, in that space, that wilderness experience. And so, you know, early 30s, mid-30s, you know, I felt like damaged goods. Like, who would want to marry somebody that's a cancer survivor? Who would want to marry somebody with such a history? Who would want to be with, who would want to commit, you know, their lives to someone with that uncertainty that it will happen again or that I might not live a long life? Or, you know, in my mind, you know, I just pictured all the reasons why no one would not want to marry me, not even thinking about the fact that, you know, I was a scholar and a gentleman and I was fine, and I was, you know, all those things I am. But, you know, when you are going through cancer, all of that is